Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Andy Phillip, and on this episode I'll be joined by Rachel Amery and Callum Ross to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read by Morag Lindsay.
Young people have given up education and work to become full-time activists against climate change, according to a leading protester. Evelyn Acham, a Ugandan activist with the Rise Up movement in Africa, said the crisis had spurred young people to abandon other parts of their lives to focus on pushing for action. She was speaking as tens of thousands of young people were taking to the streets of Glasgow to pressure world leaders into firm action at the COP26 climate summit held over the first 2 weeks of November. France and the UK have been locked in talks looking for a breakthrough on a fishing dispute caused by Brexit. Meanwhile, a Scottish registered scallop dredger, which was impounded by France last week, has arrived in the UK after being released by authorities. There is no way to know whether the coronavirus vaccine passport scheme is working, John Swinney has admitted. Scotland's Deputy First Minister said the government does not have any evidence to show if the measure is reducing the spread of coronavirus or encouraging people to get vaccinated.
Thanks, Morag. Let's turn our attention to what's been happening closer to home. And by closer to home, it's a bit of an elastic concept this week because we've had a whole roller coaster of a week of politics, or if for some people, more of a kind of downward spiral. Either way, it's not been a good week, I don't think, for the Conservative Party. It began with the golden opportunity for Boris Johnson to be a statesman on the world stage in Glasgow. More of that later. And it ended up with a resigned MP, a corruption row scandal, questions about the Prime Minister's behaviour, criticism of where they get their cash. Callum, we'll get to the big issue of Owen Paterson soon, but you've been looking at the party finances. Before this all kicked off, closer to home, you were picking over the pre-election cash for the Scottish Conservatives. So what did you find there?
Yeah, that's right, Andy. This was a story we ran on Tuesday, I think, about a donation that the Conservatives in Aberdeenshire had received and accepted in April, just before the Holyrood election, as you say. It was from a company called Unity Fishing, £20,000, I think it was. And, you know, when we looked into the company and did a check on the directors, we found that one of them was one of the skippers who were fined as part of the kind of huge blackfish scandal, which reached a conclusion kind of around 2012, almost a decade ago.
What is blackfish?
So blackfish is kind of illegal landing of fish, you know, over and above fishing boats quotas. In this scandal, there was you know, a number of skippers involved. It was millions of pounds worth of fish they were found to be landing illegally, and you know, the methods used by some of the skippers were described in court as, you know, quite devious, with secret pipes and switches at ports. So it was a huge story at the time. I mean, I should say there's no suggestion that the donation to the Aberdeenshire Conservatives broke any rules that I'm aware of, but it maybe kind of does raise some questions for the party in terms of whether it was appropriate to accept such a donation. Or, on the other hand, I suppose, whether they weren't actually aware of the background, in which case, is there an issue there? And kind of looking more wider, it's once again, it kind of highlights the difficulties that are created when money and finance meet politics. Yeah. You mentioned Owen Paterson, which we'll talk about. We've had the SNP with questions over money raised for an independence referendum campaign, but might allegedly have been spent on something else. We've had Labour over the years with its tricky relationship with the trade unions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during the pandemic, there have been these stories about Tory donors winning contracts to produce PPE and things like that. So it's tricky. I mean, voters expect politicians to be acting in their interests, but when money comes into the equation, everything becomes a bit more blurred sometimes in terms of the motivations.
I mean, the money that gets donated has to go through, you know, a regulator. It's regulated. There's very strict rules, particularly in the run-up to an election, about how and in what way the money is, obtained and declared. Of course, in this instance, obviously, the donation was made before the Scottish Parliament election this year and reported afterwards. That's correct, isn't it? It goes through the machine.
That's right, yeah. I don't know the details in terms of whether the money would have been spent on the campaign or not, but yeah, it was made, it was kind of accepted, I think, on the 6th of April, a month before the election. It wasn't kind of officially reported until August, maybe, end of the summer anyway.
I mean, it's always a big prize for any political party to have a donor with deep pockets. And in the northeast of Scotland, obviously, the Conservatives have been long having a close contest with the SNP. Rachel, how big an issue is it for parties then? Because the stakes are so high. I mean, the Conservatives have been making inroads in the northeast in particular, and I look elsewhere in Scotland at places like maybe Perthshire. The Conservatives are in second place in a lot of places where perhaps other parties, maybe the Liberal Democrats or Labour, maybe. Do you think that is the system robust enough to do voters know what they're, you know, do they just take it all at face value and can they be confident that the system is robust?
I think certainly from a public opinion, there is a lot of suspicion around party donors and sort of people are not quite sure about whether it's legitimate or not. I think that's just across the board. So perhaps from a public perception point of view, at least, it's not working enough because people don't seem to trust donations political parties are getting at the moment. And I think this week's kind of really shown how public perception can sway those things in Parliament.
Well, it's going to be tested probably a by-election quite soon. A bit south of our natural territory in North Shropshire. So this is where the Conservative MP Owen Paterson has been having some long-running fight to try and clear his name. He insists he's done nothing wrong with accepting cash where he shouldn't have. Callum, could you take us a little bit through what happened? That it's been a very twisting and turning saga, but then at the end of the week, you know, it seemed to change with every hour. Just kind of, a lot of people won't really know how we got to the point where the whole of Parliament was up in arms and there was an MP quitting.
Yeah, that's right. It was a big kind of day of drama yesterday at Westminster, kind of starting on Wednesday as well. But yeah, you're right. The case does go back a lot further. I think it's a couple of years ago when Paterson said he'd been involved in it. I mean, Owen Paterson, for those that don't know, is a former UK government minister. I think he served in David Cameron's cabinet as Northern Ireland Secretary and Environment Secretary as well. Considered a right-winger generally, enthusiastic Brexit supporter, but he was found by the Parliament Standards Commissioner and kind of confirmed by the Standards Committee of MPs that he had breached lobbying rules over his paid work for two companies, the kind of contact he was making with ministers, questions he was asking, it was said, on behalf of these companies. So, you know, he was facing a suspension. But rather than kind of nod through the committee's verdict, as would normally have happened, the government ordered its MPs, Conservative MPs, to support an amendment that basically blocked the whole process, saved Mr. Paterson, and instead paved the way for an overhaul of the entire system for investigating MPs. I mean, it was pretty incredible. It prompted a furious response, and eventually the response, this backlash, kind of led to a U-turn by Boris Johnson and his government yesterday afternoon. They've now agreed to a fresh vote, and also the kind of final twist yesterday was Mr. Paterson himself announcing that he was going to resign as the MP for North Shropshire.
Yeah, so I mean, if there was any strategy behind this whatsoever, it would appear that the Prime Minister, he seemed to have his sights on the process and the figure behind the ruling and the committee that does all these horrible things like exposing wrongdoing. but has ended up and wanted to save his own MP from what was looking like a suspension. And in the end, he's completely and utterly misjudged everything. The Parliament's reasserted itself and he's lost an MP.
That's right. And I think, you know, I saw something a couple of hours ago, I think it was in Politico, that someone had done a count and they'd now rated that this government had done 36 U-turns in the last 23 months. So less than 2 years on kind of high profile, big issues as well. You know, that shows there's something pretty wrong at the heart of this administration, I would say. There seems to be a failure to foresee these kind of problems, or maybe an arrogance that allows them, makes them think that they can get away with things sometimes that clearly they can't, or perhaps kind of an incompetence in terms of executing the plans they put in place. A lot of these things, I mean, you'd never have seen that number of kind of U-turns and the nature of them in the days of the Blair and Brown governments, or even the Tory Lib Dem coalition, or it has to be said the SNP government at Holyrood, although of course all of them have had their issues over the years.
They've had their fair share of U-turns all around, but it does seem that Boris Johnson does seem to be at the helm of a ship that's now kind of going round and round in circles. It's done so many U-turns, I'm not really sure. But to move off the sort of party's own fortunes, Boris Johnson did start the week with, like I said, I think it was a golden opportunity to be a statesman on the world stage. US President Joe Biden had flown in to what they called Glasgow, which looked suspiciously like Edinburgh. Everybody and their uncle and auntie were at COP26 in Glasgow, which we talked about a lot last week, which was very informative, our own journey to COP26. So here we are, all the world leaders are there. Rachel, what did how did Boris Johnson, you know, announce the UK's hosting of this huge climate summit, and what was the whole point of it?
Yeah, so the first 2 days of COP26, so this is the UN climate summit that's currently going on in Glasgow, Boris Johnson was meeting almost all the world leaders. There are obviously a few world leaders who did not come to the conference, but he met a lot of the famous ones, and I'm sure the big one that we all were watching was Joe Biden. There was a lot of media fanfare for his arrival. Everything that he did pretty much was it was written about in the papers, whether that was what he was eating, who he was meeting, where he was staying. Everything was very much covered about Joe Biden. So he did obviously make the opening speech at COP26, but a lot of other things I think this week have overshadowed his speech at the start of the week, and including other speeches. There's been a few world leaders who have made other speeches at COP26 which have already sort of overtaken Boris Johnson's in terms of how well it was publicly perceived. So it really just depends, but it kind of has almost been forgotten about already, because it's so much has happened this week in Glasgow, hasn't it?
Yeah, the beginning of it was there was a tremendous flurry of attention. It did seem to kind of fall off the agenda just a wee bit in the middle of the week. And I'm told that this is all very normal as well. I mean, it stands to reason you've got a huge amount of attention to start, then everyone sort of gets down to the business in the background. And then coming up after that, there's the agreements to meet, and it always goes to extra time. And it's 2 weeks long, and there's such a dizzying amount of events going on. One of the more visual aspects of it, of course, is the protest around it. Nothing like a Glen Eagles, when, you know, the police are steaming in and protesters being kettled and all that kind of thing around the country. What's the sort of mood? Have we had any glimmer of protest turning over into, you know, proper sort of disobedience and people standing up to what they see as bad governance? Or have we seen more of a collective mission at the moment? I think I'm probably right in saying, I mean, everyone in mainstream politics is signed up to this. It's not like they're being told to do something that they aren't already aiming for. So what are young people saying? I mean, they're the ones that this is going to affect the most.
Yeah, well, obviously one of the big names who is at Glasgow this week is Greta Thunberg, who started the schools protests, And she's been very vocal all week, basically saying that not enough's being done. There's a lot of sitting about and talking. The phrase blah, 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 I'm sure was used again by her this week.
It was used by Boris Johnson too.
So yeah, it's a common phrase this week. So if you were to listen to her and what she's suggesting, she thinks that not enough's being done. And that more needs to be done. There is the youth climate protest happening in Glasgow on Friday, and tens of thousands are expected to attend that protest. And they're also due to hand in a statement to Nicola Sturgeon and to Alok Sharma. He's an MP, but he's also the president of COP26, and they're to receive this statement from young protesters as well. So perhaps over the next week, when we see more of the large scale protests happening in Glasgow, we might get more of an idea of how much of an impact that's going to be having on what's happening behind the doors where all the negotiations are happening. But there's other things that are happening already at COP26. So we've had an agreement on deforestation, for example. Over 100 countries signed that, including some of the most forested countries. Brazil, I think, was the big name there, because it's obviously home to the Amazon rainforest, and it's had well-documented struggles with deforestation over the years. And there's also been pledges to cut methane gas as well. So there have been a lot of sort of quite high-profile agreements already made. A lot of it has gone down well, especially the deforestation one. Others, however, like Patrick Harvey, the co-leader of Scottish Greens, he was saying that this deforestation pledge is actually complacent because the pledge does give them until 2030 to take in the targets. So, again, a lot of reaction to what's been going on.
On the Greens there, you mentioned, they're having a bit of a first test of what it's like to be a kind of campaigning activist group and in government at the same time. Callum, have you noticed any change to the way that the Greens have been operating? Have they had to sharpen up, or are they comfortable in the role? I mean, we haven't gone into this much, but I did notice that the Greens and Patrick Harvey and Ross Grier, who's another Green MSP but not in the government, they seem to have a pretty unpredicted scrap with Greenpeace this week. Greenpeace sort of getting told by the Greens that they didn't quite understand Scottish affairs, which I thought was an amazing turnaround, and probably quite uncomfortable for the Greens in government. I mean, how are they settling into the role, and is this going to be a real test for them?
Yeah, I think that's right, and it will be a test. I think so far, I mean, I wasn't following too closely that Greenpeace angle. I was aware that there were some comments online about them looking uncomfortable. I think it's a tricky transition. It was always going to be. But, you know, we've seen Green parties do this in other countries, I think in Germany and places like that. Obviously, it's been well documented about New Zealand that they end up in government. I think it is a tricky transition, and I'm sure there are times they're not enjoying it at the moment, but it's still early days, I suppose.
I mean, Scotland's quite unique in its tension that a Green government minister can have. I mean, the oil and gas industry in Scotland is obviously, you know, it's massive, and you know, to be in a government that just a few years ago was saying, you know, the oil and gas figures are effectively baked into plans for independence, although they now say that that's not the case, to go from that to effectively having people saying we need to turn off the taps, and telling, you know, thousands of people that earn a good wage in that industry that they need to start preparing for a fairly intangible as yet future plan. Yeah, it's interesting. And I think the fact that COP is happening at this point where there's a brand new Green MSP cooperation in government, will everyone's watching, and I'm sure that the opposition are circling, but and while everyone else is watching. COP26 wasn't all about the politics as well. I mean, although it started with the world leaders, lots of news around the subject to do with climate change and deforestation, but it brings us to a little angle that passed by a little bit. It was what everyone was eating. It's not just the way we live our life around about, you know, whether we need to turn off more light bulbs and do the recycling. Everyone's watching the world leaders and how they looking for any hint of hypocrisy. Climate and conservation groups were looking at the menu, and saying it was almost 60% meat or dairy based. So is that the right image that they should be presenting, Rachel?
Well, one thing that a lot of these climate activists who are in the news and leading these protests are saying is that the world as a whole needs to move to a more plant-based diet. So yes, I can imagine a lot of people, Greta Thunberg, for example, she's one of the ones who has very much said this in the past. A few Green Party members as well over the UK and elsewhere are also quite big advocates of a plant-based diet. So yeah, I can imagine there'll be a lot of people who, on hearing that, will think, well, wait a minute here, you're telling us that we need to move away and not practicing what you preach at this conference by serving up meat and dairy products. But at the same time, it can be quite difficult if that's the diet that you're used to. It's a difficult move to make, isn't it? So yeah, I'm sure that the people eating the food probably didn't give it a second thought at the time. But obviously now there'll be a lot of scrutiny about it afterwards. I think as well with the private jets, that's another one as well that people have been a bit concerned about. There's a lot of private jets, a lot of flights. There's a big fanfare, obviously, when Air Force One came down in Scotland for Joe Biden and immediately left 2 days later. So that's the kind of thing as well that's been getting a lot of scrutiny.
Yeah, I suppose when these events present themselves to a very eager PR machine, it's easy to say, well, let's do a showcase of Scottish produce, let's do a showcase of our country, things like that. And obviously someone thought, well, we better get haggis, neeps and tatties on the menu as well. But the working out the carbon cost of all these meals, you know, despite it being a local world famous delicacy, it's one of the most damaging, it has the highest carbon footprint and way above what they were aiming for. So that brings us to the return of an old friend and the first, I think, inanimate object ever awarded our Stoosh of the Week.
Stoosh of the Week.
There you go. A menu. Anyway, that isn't how we want to end our discussion about climate change and everything that's been happening in the world of politics, because even though politicians yet again managed to conspire to end with resignations, corruptions, rows and stooshy, we can go back to the beginning. Are there any words of encouragement from any of this? I mean, are we on the right track at all? Are we going to have something to look forward to? What is David Attenborough saying?
Yes, the very first day of this conference in Glasgow, there's a lot of speeches, a lot of fanfare, people getting up on stage to music and all the rest of it and films. But I think the one that very much stood out for everyone was Sir David Attenborough. I'm sure everyone has a sort of collective fondness for him and very much listens to what he has to say. Boris Johnson himself even said, you know, people probably don't listen to me when it comes to climate change, but they will listen to David Attenborough. So his opening speech on Monday, it was very much welcomed and listened to as well. So I think everyone's quite pleased to see him getting up on stage and talking about climate change at COP26.
Even if Boris Johnson wasn't wearing a mask next to him, that wasn't enough to spoil it.
Yeah, there's a photograph came afterwards of Boris Johnson, who looked like he was falling asleep, sitting next to the 95-year-old with no mask on. So there was that as well.
Okay, well, anyway, that's it for this week. Thanks to Callum Ross and Rachel Amory and producer Morvan. And of course, to you for listening. We'll be back next week with more. But until then, and even after then, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press and Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshy or follow Stooshy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.